Chapter 16, Let's Talk Turkey by Willie Snow Etheridge. 16, Turkeys, Butte, Montana. The Moline Victory came in on a Sunday afternoon of the Byram weekend and anchored out in the harbor where a half dozen other freighters were anchored. The roommate was overjoyed to see it, but secretly I wasn't pleased. Without growing restless, I could go on living indefinitely in the ambassador's apartment with a maid, a valet, a cook, a chauffeur, a kiwas, and Betty Karp. In spite of what the roommate and the offspring say, I'm no fool. But even with the Moline in, we figured we had time to rush to Bursa, formerly Brusa, the first capital of the Ottoman Empire, and, so everybody said, a beautiful resort. To get there, we had to take a ship to the seaport of Mundanya on the Sea of Marmara, and then a bus or taxi for 10 or 15 miles to Bursa. The steamer was jammed with exhausted peasants returning to their villages from the three-day holiday in Istanbul. Most of them slept, slumped on straight chairs on deck, their mouths dropped open, their clothes wrinkled and dirty, but a few managed to stay awake to shove hunks of black bread, which they kept wrapped in newspapers when not eating, into their mouths. The Çelik Palace Hotel at Bursa is impressive. It could just as well be in Hot Springs, Arkansas, for Bursa too has sulfur springs and what Mehmed Reshid describes in the tourist practical guide as ferruginous baths. Being one who likes to live dangerously, I was all set to try out one of these ferruginous businesses. When I peered inside the one connected with the hotel and viewed a man, absolutely naked and red as a tomato, standing behind an extremely low partition, that ended it. I wasn't ready to live that dangerously. It was a disappointment, too, for the roommates in my bedroom was furnished with huge robes of softest toweling, cork-soled slippers, and other appurtenances of the bath. I learned too late to do me any good that the bathhouses were reserved certain days for men and other days for women. Our room also had other comforts in a clean, stark German manner. Evidently, the hotel had been built by the Germans during that era preceding the First World War when they poured so much money into railroads, hotels, and other investments in Turkey. They were extremely clever, too, in choosing the site of the Bellevue. It is on the outskirts of Bursa, which faces an open pastoral land that sweeps to a faraway horizon of purple hills and bright blue sky and backs against that lordly mountain that Homer and the other Greeks call Mount Olympus, after no doubt the Mount Olympus of the homeland, but which the Turks call Ulu Dağ. It is no wonder that practically everybody who has been anybody in this area of the world once slept in Bursa. According to the tourist practical guide, Hannibal himself had a hand in selecting the site of Bursa, but what Hannibal was doing so far from his home base, it doesn't say. Guidebooks scarcely ever say what you really want to know. All it says is Bursa, the ancient Prusa, was founded in 185 BC by the Bithynian king Prusias, aided by Hannibal. Now, the last time I heard about Hannibal, he was crossing the Alps with those elephants that were pregnant for 18 months. Or was that how long it took them to cross the Alps? You see how travel quickens the mind. Here I was thinking about things I hadn't thought of in years, not since I wrestled with the books of Caesar and Cicero. Hannibal was in one of those, wasn't he? Mehmed Reshid doesn't answer any of these questions. He just lets himself go on a mile-long line of conquerors, none of whom I've ever heard of before and hope never to hear of again, until he gets down to what he considers the recent date of 1326, when Brusa was taken by the Turks under Orkhan after a 10-day siege and became the capital of their empire. Then he offers this bit of advice. The best way to see the sights in and about Brusa is to start between 8 and 9 a.m. and drive to Uli Jami, thence to Yeşil Jami, proceeding there afterwards to Pınar Baki. Such talk, and to strangers. The roommate and I were outdone. We would have to find a guide who spoke English, but where? The hotel clerk could not help us. He did not speak a word of English himself. Getting a room from him had been the merest fluke. Until we were in it, we thought we might be on the way to the men's or ladies' rooms. Now that we wanted a guide, he understood us no better. But he finally telephoned for a taxi, and when it came, the taxi driver spoke a little English. "You want to see Bursa?" he asked. "You see Butte, Montana, you see Bursa." We thought we had heard him wrong, but not at all. He had worked in 1912 in the copper mines in Butte, and he was convinced that Bursa had nothing on Butte or vice versa. Both, he summed up, very mountainous and narrow, steep roads. Settled into the back of the taxi, the roommate asked why he had left Butte. "Everybody make mistake," he answered. "I came back to see my people in Bulgaria and get caught in Istanbul by war." "The last war?" I asked. "No, Mom, the first war." "How did you happen to come to Bursa?" "I know like Istanbul. Too big." I ask people, "Have you any good towns around here?" And they say, "There is Bursa." So I come and here I stay. He was as friendly as New York taxi drivers, but frequently his English failed him. It had been so long since he had spoken it, he had forgotten much of his vocabulary. Besides the glorious scenery and mineral baths, Bursa is famous for the tombs of the many sultans and princesses and princes and princesses of old Turkey, for the silk factories where the worms in person do the spinning, and for the silk bazaar where thousands of shiny bolts of gossamer soft material cascade from thousands of narrow shelves. The tombs of the Turkish sultans were crude and eerie, unpainted wooden boxes similar to our coffins, except that they were bigger and their tops were ridged like roofs, sitting casually on the dusty floors of dome structures. Over them, the boxes, not the domes, are thrown old pieces of tapestry and rugs and rags and what have you, and nearby, on poles, rest the intricately wound turbans most favored by the deceased. The mausoleum interested me particularly. I had read in Suleiman the Magnificent how Suleiman, at the instigation of his jealous wife, Roxelana, had ordered two deaf mutes to strangle with a bowstring his first son by his first wife for some ghoulish reason. I wanted to see where the son was buried. Standing a few feet away from the rag-covered box, I felt the same horror I had experienced when first reading of the murder, and my feelings were shared fully by the taxi driver. "His own father choked him?" he announced dramatically. "Boy, that was bad people. If they had told me, I wouldn't have believed it." The other was the mausoleum of Sultan Murad II. It is much talked about. Mehmed Rashid says, "Artists and amateurs should not omit to visit it." Murad is buried almost like ordinary people in the ground, and the mound above the grave is planted with grass edged with marble, but the dome of the building that encloses it is open to allow the rain and snow to fall upon it. "He left a note," the driver explained, "that nobody covers him up, and he had enough money, I guess, to fix it up before he died." Two tremendous turbans sit upon standards a little to one side of the grave, out of reach of the rain. One was Murad's Friday cap. The other he wore on Bayram days. These were a sufficiency of mausoleums from the roommate and me, but the driver insisted on taking us up a terrifically steep hill on a plateau above Bursa to see the tombs of Sultan Osman I, the founder of the Ottoman Empire, and Orkan I. The view from the edge of the esplanade was worth the climb. I sound as if I did it on foot, don't I? But I had to help the taxi. It was old and tired. Bursa, splashed with purplish-blue houses, sprawled beneath us, and beyond Bursa, that lovely, lovely green-gold valley shadowed in far places by clusters of trees. "Why so many blue houses?" I asked the driver. "The people like blue, and what they like, they paint." For an hour or more of the afternoon, we tried to track down silkworms working, But they had done their weaving for the season and were gone when all good worm gone where all good worms go. We did see in the bazaar, though, rivers of their handiwork, and though terribly confused as I always am when faced by so many choices, selected a few yards of yellow satin for the oldest offspring. At this writing, she has not made it into anything. I can tell she feels she could have done much better if she had done the choosing herself. Weary enough to ask one of the sultans to move over and let us crawl in with him under the rags, we had an early dinner on the open terrace of the hotel, suspended above the valley. For a little while, eyed sleepily the slim new moon and went to bed. And it was well we did, for we needed all our strength for the next day. We were returning to Istanbul to gather up Mr. Big and to pack. And to return to Istanbul, we would travel a different route from the one we had come. We would taxi to Yalova, a distance of about 30 miles, and catch a steamer from there to Istanbul. It seemed boats ran more frequently from Yalova than from Mudanya. The taxi trip is what took it out of us. We had to share the taxi with three mammoth Turks, two men and a woman, and none of them, including the driver, spoke a word of English. In some maneuver, which neither the roommate nor I understood, we were separated. I was on the front seat between the driver and the woman, and the roommate was squeezed in between the two men mountains. They weighed at least 300 pounds each, not counting their thick, long handlebar mustaches. They lapped far over the roommate, hiding all of him except a small strip down his middle. I honestly feared for his life. To make matters worse, one of the men either coughed or cleared his throat with every turn of the wheel, never using a handkerchief or piece of Kleenex. At one point, catching one of the roommate's eyes between the shoulders of the monstrosities, I said sympathetically, "Oh, darling, I'm afraid you'll catch TB." But instead of appreciating my sympathy, he growled, "I've no doubt already got it." I didn't blame him, though. He was in a spot. If he could only have rolled the windows down or some of the germs could escape, but the Turks kept them tightly closed. For the road, curving through lovely rolling fields, tawny with wheat and barley, that would have been a joy to see if anybody had been in the mood to see, was unpaved, and the dust billowed up like smoke from burning leaves every time we passed a car. With the windows shut, it was hot, too, and when I twisted around, I could see perspiration pouring down the roommate's nose and dropping to his shirt front. Catching his eye again, I asked, "Darling, why don't you take off your coat?" And again, unappreciative, he snarled, "Don't be a damn fool. Can you see it? Can't you see it would be a major operation and quite out of the question?" But happily, he did survive. When we reached Yalova and the Turks hoisted themselves out, the roommate took a slow, deep breath, moved cautiously to the edge of the seat, and finding no bones broken, tottered to the sidewalk. On the ship, we found places on hard benches in the warm sun and brisk wind, and after a little while, the roommate began to revive and show interest in the people around him. They were as earthy as people can get and still stand on two legs. They removed their shoes as soon as they sat down and stretched the toes of their gnarled bare feet to catch the air. Then, without washing their hands, they opened newspaper bundles stuffed with tomatoes, cheese, and bread, and cigarette packs, empty of cigarettes but filled with salt, made gargantuan sandwiches, which I thought they couldn't possibly get into their mouths, but they did. One old crone took a bite the size of a horseshoe, leaving only the crust for the next bite. Tomato juice trickled in streams down their chins and blouses. A man facing us had a hunk of cheese, white as flour, and black bread tied in a cloth sack. Every 6 or 7 minutes, he would untie the sack, plunge his hands inside, break off a piece of cheese, and tear away a slab of bread and have a snack. You might think these sights would have taken away my appetite, but nothing takes away my appetite. Watching them, I grew hungrier and hungrier, and even the roommate expressed a desire for sustenance. But there was no dining room on the boat, only a man selling cups of coffee and little bags of something that we thought were nuts. We bought two bags and began to chomp away. What a blow! They were chickpeas, the most tasteless, mealiest, unappetizing mess I ever tried. I voted them one of the two foods I do not like, ranking them even below raisins. Our stomachs clinging to our backbones, in mid-afternoon we steamed into the Golden Horn. There still sat the Moline Victory. We had seen beautiful Bursa and were back in time, too. The first thing in the morning, we would find out when to go aboard. End of chapter 16.